I'm Zach. I'm a musician, a former worship leader. I helped destroy a megachurch, and I'm not really sure what I believe anymore.
I'm Dave. I'm a Bible theology nerd, an occasional preacher, a movie buff, and still an evangelical.
Dave, we have company. Come on.
Oh, we have a guest tonight.
This is Veterans of Culture Wars.
Veterans of Culture Wars is a podcast where we talk about the beliefs, history, culture, or personal stories from evangelical Christianity. We welcome you to the podcast, whether you are a believer or not. And Zach, we have a great guest tonight. We have people from all different perspectives on the show, even though both of us are progressive, although we may be theologically a little bit different. But, you know, we've had some conservative people. We've had some liberal people. We have evangelicals, and we also have some ex-evangelical people on the show. So who do we have on this show?
Today we're going to be talking with Blake Chastain. He is the host of the Ex-Evangelical podcast, as well as Powers and Principalities. He coined the, well, can you say coined a hashtag? He started the hashtag Ex-Evangelical, which I suppose means he created the word. he can clarify that for us. I imagine a fair amount of our listeners are aware of him, but a fair amount probably aren't, depending on sort of where you land with your faith. Welcome to the podcast, Blake.
Thank you very much for having me.
Great to meet you.
So does starting the hashtag equal coming up with the concept?
So I usually use the sort of nomenclature of I started the hashtag, just because that is something that is pretty clear. Like I initially started banding around the idea of like the term ex-evangelical and having it be a show in like 2014 after leading our last sort of fundamentalist church. But that didn't really become any sort of publicly available product until like July 2016. And in the interim, there was someone that did start a blog with that domain name. So I'm not sure if it's still up or not, but there was one up with that domain. And so I really only say that the hashtag is directly attributable to me, because as far as, you know, there is definitely instances of simultaneous invention. I didn't, of people like discovering calculus, like in the same way, a term that has become popular online over the last few years, someone was probably going to come up with it. And in this instance, I was the one that turned it into a hashtag. So
maybe Twitter knows who the one is that invented it, and that's why they haven't given you the blue check mark yet.
Maybe
just waiting that person to ask. Like, got it, we're all ready for you.
I think I preferred the ex-evangelical term. It had to have been on the Liturgist podcast back when Michael Gunger and Science Mike McCarg were the main hosts, but that was probably after you started, because you've been at this podcasting game quite a 4 or 5 years now with the FML.
So I started my podcasting career, so to speak, in July of 2016. I timed it to come out the same week as the Republican National Convention, so seemed appropriate given how things have gone since the 1970s. So that's when I first started. So there may have been a chance that they had mentioned it. I haven't listened to every episode of the Liturgist by any means. But yeah, like it did sort of following the results of the 2016 election and everything that came from that, that it definitely had a sort of a groundswell. A number of people became known or associated with it to differing degrees. And then, you know, it's very interesting to me how ideas and memes sort of travel throughout social networks and stuff. And we can get super nerdy into to things like that if we yeah, want to yeah, talk yeah. about that. But yeah, it's just sort of taken on a life of its own. And I think it's actually a feature of it is that enough people can relate to it and contribute to it, that it's not solely attributable to a single person. Like I would think it actually validates it more in my opinion that it's not just associated with whatever sort of output I can do. And I'm flattered to have any sort of role in that.
And the people that use it to describe themselves are a lot bigger umbrella than I think a lot of people understand. I know when I first started hearing the term, I took it to mean people that left faith entirely that had grown up evangelical.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of people that would still call themselves Christians, but would say they're ex-evangelicals.
Yep.
And I believe you attend church still, don't you?
Yeah, I don't currently. And we sort of tapered off in starting in probably 2019. And then just with the pandemic, just became untenable for us. We have a young child and, you know, vaccinations not being available for people of their age. It's just not really something that we attend. And then we moved. So there were some life things there and just some other things that predated that. The interesting thing to me is that even through the course of doing this public work, I've gone through my own sort of different, you know, faith shifts, which is a term that that creators and writers like Cindy Wong Brandt use to describe these sort of transitions. So I've experienced that even within the space of the last 5 years. But I did, when I first started, I definitely was, you know, still engaging with Christianity in a sort of, you know, in a very active way personally, and saw this as part of continuing that conversation. To me, the reason why I thought it was interesting is, and what was the motivating factor for me starting the podcast was I went to Indiana Wesleyan, you know, and that's a sort of down the middle Christian college. And a lot of my friends that I was even loosely connected to, even just through Facebook, I started to see that a lot of us have moved away from evangelicalism if we haven't moved away from Christianity altogether. And that's what I wanted to explore. And that includes people that are still faithful to Christianity in some way and those that aren't.
Yeah, I think that's a massive misunderstanding out there. And there have been pieces written, I think, even in the last couple of months of, I think people in my camp, evangelicals, they hear ex-evangelical and they're immediately thinking, you know, heretic or atheist or agnostic. Mm-hmm. But I mean, it could be on like the biggest spectrum possible, right? It could be an atheist agnostic now. There could have been a faith shift to another religion. Could have been, you know, someone could have become Catholic or Greek Orthodox, or, I mean, it's, you know, it's endless where people could be at that take the ex-evangelical label. But maybe we should back up. You mentioned that you went to Indiana Wesleyan. And I think for our audience that's not familiar with you or the great work you've been doing on the ex-evangelical podcast, maybe, you know, how were you raised and shaped by evangelicalism?
Sure.
What role did that play in your life, just the highlights as you grew up?
Yeah, I mean, my upbringing, I grew up in Indiana before moving to the suburbs of Chicago in high school. In Indiana, we attended a small town United Methodist Church. We UM experiences, I like to describe as, even though the general sort of feeling about the United Methodist denomination is that it is a more progressive or mainline, maybe leaning moderate denomination, it actually takes on a lot of what I just say it always takes on the local flavor. So when you're in a predominantly white small town, it's going to be more conservative than if you go to UM Church in downtown Chicago. For me, like, that did mean that I did have my first pastors were women. So like egalitarianism was just sort of presumed, but that was also contrasted with sort of the example of my grandparents' churches, which were more directly self-governed small Christian churches in Southern Indiana. But overall, like within those two church environments, I had a really sort of positive feelings about religion and Christianity, and was always sort of prone towards that sort of thing, drawn to questions about God and things like that. And then when I moved into high school and got really into youth group culture, because it was the late 90s and and it was just in the air. I think we're all maybe around the same age, like geriatric millennial, like late 30s or so.
Right. And you listen to Pete Mail bands, I'm assuming, and DC Talk had their Supernatural album, I think, around that time.
Yeah, and there was Jesus Freak, and yeah.
Okay.
And like, I worked at a Christian bookstore. I spent all my, had a sweet 35% discount on books and music, and just
35. Just, that is sweet.
Yes. So I bought a lot of Philip Yancey and a lot of, you know, Switchfoot and whatever other stuff.
I was just talking about Philip Yancey with some friends a couple nights ago. He always, when I was first told about him, it really threw me, because I went to high school with a serious metalhead and incredible classically trained pianist named Yancey Phillips. And so I just always like picture Philip Yancey as, I mean, he looks like Bob Ross, but I always pictured him
with
super long hair and painted fingernails.
Yeah. So, I mean, I was a very active sort of youth group kid and everything. And at the ripe old age of 17, felt the call to ministry in air quotes there, selected Indiana Wesleyan because of that conviction. And during I enrolled, the school was really big on double majors, the history department in particular. So I double majored in history and biblical literature. And the first full week of school is when 9/11 happened. And the history department, the chair was very hawkish and sort of pushing a lot of stuff. And then what I can now identify as Christian Reconstructionism, a lot of talk about the biblical Christian worldview. That was when I had my first crisis of faith, because I was comparing and contrasting that to learning Koine Greek and understanding how the Bible was constructed, and developing my own political awareness that was far more liberal than what was being exemplified for me. And that's when, from there, to summarize the story a bit more, like from 2005 when I graduated, got married a couple years later, that crisis of faith made me not want to actually go to seminary, but I did work and then went to grad school part-time. Ended up discovering creation care theology, and that sort of rekindled what I would hope would become like a progressive evangelical theology and existence.
Not so much.
It didn't work out.
Yeah.
And part of that was because of work being in a complementarian church. My wife and I were not complementarian in our relationship and our theology and the way we wanted to raise our child, and as a result, had a conflict with the leadership there, had to leave, and by most people were holy ghosted, if you've heard that term, you know, of being sort of, you know, and that was sort of the last time I tried to exist in evangelical spaces. And I mean, if white guys have trouble existing in white evangelical spaces than anybody else that's has any other type of marginalized identity is going to have a much harder time. So
it was college your first experience with Christian education?
Yeah. So I actually did attend public schools. So that was like homeschooling, or Christian education is not part of my story. I have plenty of friends that is part of their story, but for me, like, Christianity was always around. But that particular part of it was not my experience until college.
It's always interesting hearing about the contrasts of the faith environment people experienced if they went to a Christian school and their church, especially, you know, a lot of people go to their church's school. In my case, I went to like a Vineyard church and a Baptist school. It's like a lot of different worlds colliding there. Would you say that, do you still enjoy reading the Bible?
It's actually really, I don't know. It gets difficult. So one of the things, that actually was sort of after that experience, and I know that I just sort of summarized my entire like faith journey up to a point, fairly quickly, even though I feel like it went on a bit. One of the things that ended up becoming healing for me later on, was after we were unchurched for a couple of years after that experience, and took some time off, and then following the 2016 election, felt like we wanted to be involved in some sort of faith community, and actually found a really amazing Episcopal church. And then we became confirmed in, and we actually became confirmed in the Episcopal church. And I really enjoyed that approach to theology, like that type of like the lectionary element of things and the ritual. But sort of reading the Bible in that evangelical way, whether it's of a devotional purpose, that doesn't really resonate for me anymore. And like, but I cannot shake some of the lessons that I learned that were really positive in Bible college. Like my Greek professor really emphasized, we did parts of the Philippian hymn, which is in Philippians 2, which is it's basically like an early hymn that's directly in about how Christ, about kenosis, and did not consider equality with God something to be desired, and etc. Like that is still like for me a driving part of my ethic, but I understand it personally in my context of like, that's an example of someone that had literal godly privilege and then chose to abdicate it. And what does that mean for someone that has a lot of unearned privilege now? But like some sort of evangelical devotional stuff is not something I care for. It just more unsettles me than anything, but I do like studying the history of the Bible. Like I listened to James Kugel's How to Read the Bible and it was fascinating, you know? But other approaches to the Bible are not as easy for me to sort of, to have, I guess. That's a very granular answer to a, well, you might have been, I could have said yes or no.
It's interesting. I was looking at the Wikipedia page of Exvangelical, and
which is a new occurrence. That's pretty wild.
I was wondering how new it was because it references the Rise and Fall of Mars Hill podcast, which we've talked about a fair amount on
really?
Here. Yeah. I'm looking that up. Some of the quotes here. Yeah. Cause I mean, obviously, you know, you host the podcast, your history with it is very theologically rich and you were very intellectual and learning as much as you can. But there is a sense from some people, and this was This was said by somebody on that podcast, and that's the quote on the wiki page here, that a lot of ex-evangelicals have a very surface level understanding of scripture, that, you know, essentially it's the argument of like, well, if you left the faith, you must have never really been part of it to begin with, sort of thing. Like the quote that we have here, so Matthew Lee Anderson said in the podcast that ex-evangelicals, that it's something very different than deep, difficult self-examination in order to find the truth. And also that any bad experiences that drove people to leave were, quote, sociologically actually quite marginal experiences inside of white evangelicalism. And it's just, it's so infuriating to hear something like that and to have them just brush aside anybody's like deep felt lived experience and conviction that is oftentimes born out of a deep familiarity with the text and long history with it.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm somebody that like, I didn't connect with the super emotional way of doing church that I grew up in with Vineyard and Four Squares and all that, you know, mm-hmm. The charismatic strain of things. And so part of what drove me to Mars Hill, you know, really it was, you know, the tooth and nail band thing. But when I got in there and Mark preached, it was long sermons, you know, referencing sociology, psychology, art, history, all of this, that was, you know, had it felt very intellectual compared to what mm-hmm. I'd experienced. And there was a lot of people there that went really deep into scripture and knew a ton about it and are not Christians anymore. Like I can think of like four or five worship leaders from that church that aren't believers at all anymore.
Sure. And yeah.
That just seems wild. I mean, in your experience, and maybe it's partially because they're plugged in enough to know the term ex-evangelical, but do you find ex-evangelicals tend to be more learned, more aware of what's actually in the Bible than the average Christian?
I mean, it may depend on some other aspects of their you know, life experience, but a lot of what I sort of see this as, and what I'm trying to draw attention to right now, is that this is just sort of a recent manifestation of a much older, you know, a much longer trend. It goes back, even if you look at the books that were able to make it to publication, like Marlene Winnell's foundational text,
yeah,
Leaving the Fold, was published in 1993. So like to quote Caveman's Call, I come from a long line of leavers, you know, out of the garden gate with an apple in their hand, you know, like this is not a new occurrence of people struggling. Like actually, if you listen or read books like Adam Latz's Fundamentalist You, there were people in the 1950s struggling with this, writing their parents and saying, I wish I'd never learned of a college, because they in the 1950s were struggling with under the same weight of trying to reconcile fundamentalist evangelicalism versus the insights of modernist biblical criticism. Right. I mean, this sort of stuff, like I'm thankful that I went to a Bible college that at least surfaced that. It's not like we went deep into like the JEDP sourcing of the Pentateuch or anything like that. But those things were at least present, even if they wouldn't publicly make a statement over whether they believed in it. And like these are the people that use this term are people that took youth group seriously. Caitlin,
we record at youth group time for a reason. Yes. This is 8 p.m. on a Wednesday.
That's right.
Because that has been set aside for most of my life. Ever since that fateful day when I was literally kidnapped by the youth group and blindfolded as a way to trick me into going. And I was like, oh, I guess this is cool. It was just Stockholm syndrome ever since.
I mean, like, it's not, actually Caitlin Stout has a really powerful sort of really powerful thread on Twitter that goes back to, I think, February of this year, which was about this, is about how people, when we were young, we took what you said seriously, and we examined the character of Jesus as, you know, as presented in the Gospels, and that guy gave away free healthcare and food. You know, he wasn't Republican. He wasn't even white. And I mean, yes, that is reductive and all of these things. But what I loved about their thread was that it concludes with this idea, is that we're not there. The people that leave white evangelicalism aren't dropouts. They're graduates, which reframes things a bit, you know. And when I was a child, I was preoccupied with childish things. There's like, you can proof text this shit. Like, sorry, I didn't ask if I could swear.
Yeah, no,
you can say whatever you want.
We do. Yeah, I was, our very first episode, I like immediately dropped the F bomb because I was like nervous, or because they, you know, they psychologically say that's a great icebreaker when you meet somebody new. And I was meeting our audience.
I will say when I was at Christian College, one very, very timid act of rebellion was I carried around a book about the history of swearing. And it was,
what you were saying about that thread, and, you know, we took you seriously is the attitude we have towards the evangelicals that raised us mostly. That's the whole thing about 2016, isn't it? It's, we took it seriously. We thought you took it seriously. But you abandon everything that we thought was a principle in order to support this guy. And it wasn't a conviction. It was a convenience. You just never actually been challenged on it. So,
yeah. Yeah. There's a very good chance that you both probably are familiar with David Bazan and Pedro Lyon.
Yeah.
And one, I think my favorite encapsulation of that emotion is actually from his song People on a Strange Negotiations album, because he says, when I was young, I saw people helping people. And then later on, in one of the leads into, I don't know if the right term is bridge, but basically he says, but then your eyes turned green and you broke the machine that when handed to you was still kind of functioning. And like, that is sort of evocative of what I think a lot of people see. And it's not that these things weren't present. Like, if you read Robert Jones's White Too Long, I mean, white supremacy is riddled through white Christianity in every single hit denomination. It's not just the evangelical ones, and it's for the entire history of our country. There's presences of all of these things going back a long way, but there was also really positive stuff that we tried to hold on to. But at some point, the problem that I think people, when evangelicals are not really being gracious or listening to ex-evangelicals, and they try to scapegoat that experience or say, oh, that was a marginal experience. First of all, I think you should be concerned with the margins, like, because that seems to be what the parable of the lost sheep is about, is someone that is on the margins.
Absolutely.
So first of all, you should be concerned about the margins, but also these sorts of things that people have brought up, they have tried to do it within the confines of evangelicalism and have either been expelled or have been manipulated to those margins with the intent of them leaving quietly or leaving. So in that respect, I don't like the arguments about ex-evangelicals sort of not being familiar with the with the content of evangelicalism, and oftentimes it's quickly followed by, oh, you just left to sin or whatever, to sin, you know. I have, you know, issues with that as well. And I mean, if you want to talk about theology, like we can talk about it in theological terms too. Like, I do think that evangelical as a term is like an apophatic type of theology, and that it's defined by describing what it isn't. That's one aspect of the sort of approach to things, but that might be more particular to the way I understand it.
What I find really fascinating about your story, thinking back to 2016, is It sounds like you were as horrified about not only the election of Donald Trump, but the embrace of him by, I mean, you know, we should clarify and say the white evangelical church for sure, because I don't think other groups were nearly as supportive, even within evangelicalism, evangelicals. But your family, and you had this sense that after the election happened, that I'm remembering in our conversation here tonight, you felt like, oh my gosh, I have to go back to a faith community. And was that related to the election? Was that like, you know, what is happening in our country right now? How is this guy going to be the president? And you started looking for a church or a place kind of to maybe spiritually prop up.
Yeah. That. Yeah. I mean, I think there was a sense of sort of feeling adrift. I don't speak on behalf of my partner, my wife, just because her story is her own. Most of our married life, you know, we found so much of our community beyond our friends, that we'd known through other means in faith communities. And that is still like a powerful, feature of any faith community. So, the idea of returning to one, was valuable. And we were sort of in a space where it was one of those periods where, you know, as people get older, they, you know, might have to move for work. And we were sort of in that spot, you know, and that was what sort of drew us back. And I do look at that period as really powerful. And the rector, Pastor Deborah, was an incredibly kind and conscientious spiritual leader. Like, and that was the sort of thing that, that was magnetic, and kept us involved in that community, was how tender she was and understanding, and also how wonderful she was with our daughter. So those things drew us back, and being able to sort of discover other aspects of Christianity. Because I mean, it's a 2,000-year-old religion. There's a lot to play with.
Yeah.
And there's a lot even, and that's just to be a little glib, but I mean, there's a lot to discover. There's a lot to appreciate. And so exploring a different tradition was liberating in its own way.
You mentioned Marlene Winnell's book. I still have not finished it. I've been talking about it on this show for like 6 months, but I go through it like two pages at a time, because it's like every other line is hitting me. You know, there's just so much in there that speaks to my precise experience that it's like, if I power through this, I'm going to forget far too much. Like, I really want to take my time with it.
Yeah.
But reading her, reading Jamie Lee Finch's book, You Are Your Own, both of those kind of helped me recognize the cycles I found myself in as I get more distance from faith, cycles of confusion to anger to now where, like, I honestly find myself going back and forth between not caring about evangelicalism and caring, but wish I didn't. and feeling some amount of responsibility to help other people by talking about my experience, particularly with Mars Hill. But I often question if doing this is bad for my mental health, which is something my therapist wants to take my temperature on whenever we meet. How do you experience those cycles, and how has your work in this space impacted your mental health?
That's a great question. And I think it's something that people that are doing sort of public dialogue about these sensitive things have to contend with, whether that's publicly or just personally. For me, I have a full-time job and a family, and so this is not something that I am able to dedicate all of my time to. And there was a period where I was burning the candle at both ends. I burnt out on it. And there is an aspect of, I believe the term is secondhand trauma, I'm not even in one way. People trust me with their stories, not in the same way that they do a therapist or anything, but they trust me to be a custodian of them in telling part of their story publicly. And that's not always easy. And I think the other element of things is the way, especially in the last few years, we've all lived so much online, and that those trends have only accelerated through the pandemic. And those sorts of things are really magnified. And so I'm always a proponent of recognizing your own limits, and recognizing when you need to step away. I put the show on hiatus in 2019 because there was some online drama that happened, and I was dealing with personal grief over a loss of a loved one in our life, and couldn't do it all, and that was part of my experience. And I think it is something we as a culture or a community, or I think of it more as multiple simultaneous communities online, we have to be aware of our own bandwidth and how we contribute to things, and also not knowing where someone else is in their own journey with these things. So it's not always easy, but it's something that you have to sort of develop an awareness of, and be cognizant of, and be sort of protective of your own resources. And that's actually something that if we've been in unhealthy evangelical churches, we've been sort of discouraged to do. If you've been in a church with volunteer burnout, then you know exactly what I'm talking about. Because the way they sort of gaslight you into doing more and more. And when you internalize that, it's not always easy to shut that off. So how about for both of you? If you don't mind, I know, Zach, you mentioned it there. And when you asked me that question, but how do either of you sort of feel about doing this show and what other sort of communities you participate in this way?
You want to go first, Dave?
Sure. Yeah. I'm probably a little unique among. That's a great question. being still an evangelical, your story is actually kind of similar to mine in some ways, Blake, which is really interesting. We moved during the pandemic in 2020, and just basically, to a different part of the greater Seattle area. So we haven't really found the church either. We both want to be back in some kind of faith community, but a conversation that my wife and partner, Misha and I have had is where our viewpoints are at this point with theology and politics and everything else. It'll be really hard, even in the greater Seattle area, even with where we're at, to find a church that lines up with what we believe in and what we're doing. So we've been having like a back deck church with good friends of ours, you know, just a very, very small group, and just kind of reading the Bible together and praying for one another and talking about life together. So we've really enjoyed that when we can do that. I don't necessarily feel a lot of trauma on that topic that you were talking about related to church, because I don't think that any church that I have been a part of, even including Mars Hill, I wouldn't characterize as there was any person or group of people that like hurt me personally. I don't think that's a part of my story. And I realize and affirm that that is a part of a lot of people's stories, as we're hearing on your podcast, as you know, with the online community out there. But I do think that I feel a trauma with what we were talking about before, the 2016 election. I think after he got elected that next morning, there was a sense of anxiety and panic within me and a bewilderment of how could the people that I, you know, since I was 14, I was converted to evangelicalism when I was 14, how could the people who have taught me morality and ethics and even said, you know, in a conservative lens, okay, you believe what is right. And, you know, we got to take our apologetics and we got to tell the world what is right and all that stuff. The people have taught that, how could they elect this guy who was so obviously and clearly over any, like, you know, I mean, how many red flags did we go through just in this campaign alone, you know?
Right.
How could that have happened? So I think there is a trauma associated with that, with the fact that I've just been, I'm not generally an angry person, but I have been really angry at our politics for the last 4 or 5 years and kind of carrying that. I don't yell and scream. A lot of it with me is just internal. And I felt all that, and that's led to a lot of disillusionment. So I think that's kind of,
sure,
you know, my part of it with where I'm at.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I, secondary trauma is, so before doing this podcast in 2014, I started with a couple friends, a website that was just sharing people's stories about their experiences at Mars Hill. It was during that, the high time of various things were getting unearthed. But Mark still had such a hold on people that people weren't trusting any outside sources. Everybody that wasn't part of the community could not be trusted. They were haters. They were always out to get us, you know, all that stuff. And so our whole idea was, we're going to put our stories out there. We're going to put our names on them, and we're going to tell them, you know, we're part of the people that built this community. We care about you. Our point of view at the time was, we feel God brought us to Mars Hill and God brought us out of Mars Hill. And here's the stories. And it became a really, really valuable thing for a lot of the people still there. One of the only things that they would trust, that they would follow the link to. And, but I was, you know, vetting people's stories. People were sending in all these awful experiences. And I was having to, you know, track down like a friend of it, some person that I would have a connection to where I could say, hey, do you vouch for this person? I don't know anything about them, but they sent me this. I got to trust that it's true before I put it out. And carrying a lot of people's trauma throughout that year or so of doing that. And in that time, I didn't publish it on our site, but I was the one that leaked the William Wallace rants. The folks that started this site with me were instrumental in doing that. One of them just basically, we knew where they were on the Wayback Machine. He went screenshotted them, another made the PDF, and then I disseminated it through the Facebook groups and things. And So that led to me seeking out a therapist for the first time. Mm-hmm. I had left Mars Hill in 2009, but I was going to an Acts 29 church in Seattle. It was the only Acts 29 church in the area. I think they didn't allow them for a long time because they were competition with Mars Hill. But pretty much everybody that went there were people that had left Mars Hill, and mm-hmm. were mostly people that we knew when Mars Hill was like 200 people and running the concert venue. That was where I first went. And so it was very much just like I was still at a little Mars Hill. And so I sought out a therapist as we ultimately left that church and Acts 29 stuff in general, and ended up going to a Nazarene church and mm-hmm. and learned about ambiguous loss and grief and dealing with these big changes in our lives that aren't the death of somebody, but the death of a part of ourselves, right. our community, our understanding of ourselves and our identity. You know, there were so many people leaving the church and in different stages of leaving, that a lot of them like didn't want to like be open about it and talk to everybody and be like, hey, you know, here's where we stand and here's the church we're going through. You know, just sort of, you know, they Holy Ghosted, you know, they didn't want to cause a big stir. And so there was a lot of a lot of confusion about, you know, how much of our team's still together, you know. And you know, people went to different churches. We ended up going to a church that none of our friends went to. And so we lost a lot of friendships because they were centered around being physically present with each other once a week.
Right. And
so they like yeah. really honed in on their friendships with the ones that did go with them to a certain church. And we were just kind of left out, and that was super difficult. And I spent 5 years at the Nazarene church. And so 2014 through 2019, July 21st, 2019 was my last day. And the 2016 election was huge. You know, I was playing on a worship team with Trump fans. Mm-hmm. I remember I think the day after the election, we had practice and I came in early, and it was unlocked for whoever would show up. And I remember just turning up my amp as loud as possible and just making the noisiest, like terrible sounding squelches for like 25 minutes or so. And just like this cathartic release. And I've never been that kind of a musician, like, oh yeah, I talk through my instrument, man. But like, I just, you know, I lived in a little house. You know, when I do record music, it's like after my kids go to bed and I got sure. headphones yeah. on. And so church was a way to be loud. And yep. I got it out in that moment. I turned it off and I saw like the door was open. Like the rest of the band was just like standing, waiting for me to finish so they could come in. And like, hey, how's it going?
Hey, at least they gave you that space. They knew you were processing something.
They didn't actually. We left along with the worship leader, mm-hmm. and yeah, my dad died in 2018, mm-hmm. and after that, it was like, all right, you got to send me this song list in advance. I'm not going to play good father or whatever. Like I don't want to do any songs about dads for quite a while. This is going to be weird. And it was already weird enough playing stuff there because they were doing, you know, Hillsong things. And I was in a band at Mars Hill. I was used to like, you know, we are a band and we write songs and mm-hmm. like, this is our deal. So I didn't know the majority of the popular worship songs. But it was weird. Like I have a new therapist now that specializes in religious trauma syndrome. And it was so wild. Like when I got that first one, I was like, I got to find a therapist who is a Christian, but like a real therapist so that they'll understand where I'm coming from. And then finding my last therapist, like, all right, I have to find a therapist who is not a Christian because right. I need them to yeah. understand where I'm coming from now, but I need them also to understand where I came from. So I found a therapist who's like, his dad was an executive in charge of like all like the youth division of the Free Methodist denomination. Mm. And he saw a lot of the behind the curtain stuff. The way that I saw stuff with like, I attended conferences with my parents had a worship leader supply store essentially. And like, I was like 14 going to the Christian Booksellers Association conference and, you know, meeting Charlton Heston and stuff like that. And meeting, you know, heads of publishing companies and, mm-hmm. you know, I worked for them for a while and learned a lot about that. But yeah, now I'm, you know, working through this stuff and taking on a lot of secondary trauma as I talk to people here. And especially as we deal with, we've had several episodes about the Rise and Fall of Mars Hill podcast mm-hmm. and like trying to bring on people that can help us center the victims and, right. and do the things that is not doing. Like,
yeah,
it's yeah. listening to it is re-traumatizing. And every time I hear them have somebody on to talk about how fucking gifted Mark was, like he's just like the tagline of that is just like the rise and fall of a gifted communicator.
Like, yeah, I mean,
just constantly yeah. saying that. Right. But I'm, you know, yeah. I'm not out as an ex-evangelical. I am on this podcast, but I don't post about this podcast on social media except Twitter, where none of my family is. Mm-hmm. None of my family knows that. I mean, they know that we stopped going to church, but they kind of excuse it because of the pandemic, I guess. So
yeah, yeah.
I'm not ready to deal with that. Like, I right. don't know if I'm going to be like cut out of the family, either on right. mine or my wife's side of the family. I honestly don't know.
I'm really, yeah. really sorry.
You haven't left faith entirely, but I guess, you know, you're a fairly public person with this mm-hmm. podcast. It's well known. How early into doing it were you, you know, out, so to speak, with your family?
Yeah. I mean, there were different periods. I think they've always sort of known that I, you know, I grew up, you know, listening to Rush Limbaugh, not the Canadian band that is like living in the limelight or anything.
I was listening to him in high school that I've talked about on the show before. So unfortunately,
one of my friends that he got me into Rush and I got him into youth group, and I think he got the raw end of that deal.
Wow.
Nobody got into Al Franken. You never read Rush Limbaugh is a Big Fat Idiot by Al Franken?
I've seen the cover. No.
I've seen the cover too, but so I mean, like, I'm definitely more liberal than other parts of my family, and like there have been times like I was already pretty you know, politically outspoken with my family back even in like the late Bush era. I'm pretty sure I told them I don't want an evangelical to ever be president again. Cause like, even like the war in Iraq was my sort of political awakening. And even though I was still like very sort of emotionally fraught and angsty about it all. But you know, once my friends started, some of my friends enrolled from college and high school, and we lost a family member, you know, like the things get personal, and then you start to get a little more vocal. But even through the podcast, like, it's always sort of existed in this liminal space that has been open. And I think at least in the way I approach things, I'm not by any means like anti-theist. To me, the least interesting question is, are you still a Christian? That is just, it limits the conversation on both sides, because you're just playing that evangelical game that I'm not necessarily interested in. I'd rather hear like, what's helping you to flourish? You know, what's helping you to, what inspires you? What was your story? Those are softer questions. Those are not like clear yes and no things. And even if someone was going to press me, like, I would probably say, you know, like, to boil it down to a couple of words, I'd probably say I'm a Christian agnostic. I have a very Christian oriented and informed ethics. But I'm not sure about the existence of God. It doesn't preoccupy me like it did through most of my life. I'm more interested in how ideas about God affect people's internal lives, how it affects them, how it affects how they live, how they understand themselves, how they live in the world, more than whether they understand whether God created the world or has a hand in it. Those are not the sort of theological questions that that interest me at this point in my life. But I'm also, like, a statement of no belief to me is just as binding as a statement of belief. So I'm happy to exist in that liminal space. And even though it doesn't feel very liminal anymore, I feel like I have sort of settled into it, like this idea of being agnostic, and that I can't say for certain. And I think that's just an honest admission of faith. Like, faith is faith. It's not certain. Like, it's not certainty. Like, and I'll admit, like, my whole faith journey has pretty much been in the Arminian side of things. So, like, you know, John Piper writes me off as a heretic in the introduction to his books. So
he's already said, like, farewell, Blake Chastain.
He doesn't know who I am, but his son has 1.3 million followers on TikTok and uses the hashtag. So, I mean, but yeah, that's sort of how I think about spirituality. It's even though, like, whether I, and something I've said before, that has been a really powerful sort of teaching that I read from Thich Nhat Hanh's book, Living Buddha, Living Christ. He has this passage where he's talking about how it's not your beliefs. Your beliefs are supposed to change. It's not your beliefs that shape you. It's your practices. And even though I don't like have a practice of attending church right now, I can look back at our time in the Episcopal Church. And one of the things I really valued was how much they put into their rituals. And the fact that you can say these words, and even if you're not feeling it that day, you can still say them. You can still say them with other people. You can still take communion. You can still pass the peace. And that's representative of something that actually you can track a lot of that through thousands of years of fellow human beings who've had this particular understanding of the world. And that's powerful. But yeah.
Nice.
You've spoken on your podcast several times with David Bazan. You brought up Page of the Lion mm-hmm. earlier. I think as white guys talking about evangelicalism and this, mm-hmm. which is sort of by default white, I think a lot about his line. You were too busy steering the conversation toward the Lord to hear the voice of the Spirit begging you to shut the fuck up. And I feel like that should be like my mantra sometimes. And this is just let you bring in other people's stories, let them tell their stories, and try not to invade that and get all over that. But I'm wondering about what his songs have meant to you. So I first saw Pages of the Lion in 1997 when I was 15. He played at my church, and it was about a month before I was diagnosed with cancer, actually. And so like major shift in my life happened like in that space. It was the first like, I mean, I would call it a punk show because it's not a concert venue. It's not an arena. It's a small thing. And I think of what he's doing as being connected to the punk tradition, but independent music, whatever, underground show. It was my first small show. And when I got a job, his first album was the first thing I bought a Discman, and I bought It's Hard to Find a Friend. And
some good shit.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah. It had like 7 second anti-skip. So yes. and the album is good too. But yeah, I was one of those people that absolutely like, I like to say that I've my spiritual journey in adulthood has kind of been one of, I went from The Secret of the Easy Yoke to Hard to Be. I was absolutely relating to the words of that song on the first record of feeling alienation in a church, not connecting with, you know, all these people that are there that, you know, it had a reference at the time to the WWJD bracelets that everybody was wearing. It was such a big trend, which I don't know if people listening now understand what he's even talking about in that line, you know, the devoted were wearing.
Well, have you seen Stimulators, but have you seen Stimulators, EP, cover art? It harkens back to that. It was like,
I didn't pick up on their
single, at least. Anyways, just look at it. This is a podcast, so referencing album art is probably not the best idea.
I've heard that. What is it? Preacher's kid, pastor's kid. Which one is it? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
One of those two. I've heard that and found it to be really, really startling. And I'm not usually a lyrics first person. But those really, really got me. So I connected so much with that. I saw him enough early that I still in my head, when I listen to the recorded version, when it gets to the instrumental part at the end, I'm still hearing in my head him singing In a Moment I'm Alive Again, which he only would do live. That, you know, entering the church, feeling alienated, not connecting, not feeling like part of the thing, but then somehow, some way, still finding a connection to God in there. And I'm wondering if there's particular songs that you felt, I'm not going to say defined you, but really had a lot to do with your understanding of yourself and your faith as you were getting older and approaching it differently.
Yeah. I mean, this is the place to do to have this conversation. I can't overstate how much of a lifeline that music was. And it was totally unexpected. It was actually, I think it was, I can't recall in the moment whether it was my freshman or sophomore year. I think it was my freshman year. I was in like this band at college, like my best friend that I met the first day of college. You know, he was a guitar player, sort of on the prowl for anyone that might have a bass in their dorm room. And I brought my bass. And eventually it was actually our singer that introduced both me and him to Pedro the Lion's music, you know, in Hodson Hall in Indiana, on Indiana Wesleyan's campus. And It's Hard to Find a Friend was a really big album. And I did find a lot of solace in Secrets of the Easy Yoke for several years. And sort of even when I was in that first faith crisis, it was sort of this comfort, like, especially that line, I still have never seen you, and sometimes I don't love you at all. You know, I mean, that's just like,
I never heard anything in my life like that before.
Right. I mean, the only other song is that the hymn that I'm blanking on right now, the one that mentions a fetter. I can't remember. Either prone to wander, vision. Lord, I feel it prone, yeah. Prone to leave the God I love.
Yeah.
You know, which he covers.
Which he recorded, yeah.
You know, like that was the only sort of thing that was evocative of that. And then by my Achilles Heel came out my senior year, and actually like someone found like a leaked copy of it. But like I would, anytime he's basically within like the tri-state area, from that point on, I would see him. The first time I saw him in concert was a solo show at Taylor, because Indiana Wesleyan just was not the cool campus. There were a couple of outfits that would make it. Like I did see 238 there. Earth Suit did a really awkward concert my freshman year. But beyond that, all the good music went to Taylor. I saw him there. And he like performed I Do, which like I was not ready for. And then, but at one of this Hard to Be is really powerful. People, which I mentioned earlier. And then actually the way, the other thing that's really been powerful too is how he's changed the lyrics to The Fleecing over the years. So, you know, when he first recorded it, he said that the third time he sings through the chorus, you know, I could tell you why I doubt it and why I still believe. And then, you know, and then later he changes it to why I don't believe, and why I don't need it. And all those sorts of things. That's not the end of the lyric. But,
I saw him a few months ago and he did a lyrical change that I hadn't heard him do before, in Bands with Managers. That was really reflective of the place he's at these days. The line, you know, where he says, talking about, they're in their touring van and he's not at the wheel, but he's okay. He says, I trust T William Walsh and I'm not afraid to die. Mm-hmm. And like, they even like put that on a shirt, which is very inside baseball. like you really gotta like know T.W. Walsh to buy that shirt. But he changed that to I finally trust myself, and I'm not afraid to die, and that really hit me as one of the big things in deconstructing has been learning that my heart isn't evil and corrosive and tainting everything I ever try to do. That I used to believe that there was absolutely no way that I could do a single purely good thing, that mm-hmm. that it was always going to have some sort of taint of that sin nature. Yeah. And being able to listen to myself and my heart and my body has been really powerful, and that little tweak in the line I thought was really neat.
Yeah, that's,
I love when he does stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah. And like if you know it, you know it. Like it's definitely but I that's what's so cool about him as a performer, is that he's always engendered that sort of participation from the people that come to see him. I don't know of any other act, even to this day, that takes questions in the middle of a set while they're tuning, you know, things like that. Like, and the fact that he's always wrestled with these things publicly, he's definitely one of those people that's part of the long line of believers that I mentioned earlier. You know, he's right there. And he's really important to a lot of people because of that. And it's really cool to see that. Like, I was fortunate to go to Wild Goose this year, and I saw a like a round table type thing that was Jennifer Knapp and Semler together, and like the way in which they were able to talk on stage about how Jennifer Knapp's music encouraged Semler to in their own journey and as an artist, and that's you can't overstate that. Like, anytime someone's vulnerable enough to tell their part of their story, that they're being brave, and maybe that gives someone else the bravery they need whenever they're ready. And that's one of the most beautiful parts about being human.
That's cool. And you probably don't, you may find this interesting. I think it's interesting, but I have a couple of friends, ex Mars Hill people that, produce the documentary about Dave.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
he was never like directly, he's always distanced himself from that, but it is, it's still kind of funny that there's a,
I had the director on too. Mm-hmm. And yeah, Brandon. So I've only talked to him really during that period, but I love the documentary. Was really great. And
it was powerful.
Captured a lot of that.
I always thought about that shot of, you know, because he was talking about his faith wrestling, and there's, I think, like a drone shot of, I don't know if it was in Virginia or wherever, where you have these rolling green hills and there were these roads going off in the distance. I mean, mm-hmm. Talk about a faith journey, right? It's just kind of getting that artistic image in there.
Right.
So that was really beautiful.
I agree. I love that. All those really wonderful, like, expansive shots. Mm-hmm. Like, and they just let the documentary itself sort of breathe. Cause I mean, that's what music like that allows. That's what podcasts allow. That's what, you know, Instagram and TikTok allow. Like, whenever, like, for some people, that's the place where they go and where they get that, the space that they need, that, that thing that, you know, deep crying out to deep. Sort of.
All comes back around full circle. You doing the Exvangelical podcast, and you talk to just, you know, a range of, sometimes it's normal people, scholars, thinkers, all about, you know, evangelical Christianity and faith shifts and things of that nature. While none of us have a crystal ball, like, it seems like evangelical Christianity, there are some real fractures and divisions right now. Mm-hmm. There's, Misha was just talking to me tonight about a church that we never went to, but we are aware of, that's like just going hard right and having Eric Metaxas and people like that come and speak at it. There are other churches that maybe trying to maintain like some kind of status quo, even while we have all of this disruption in our society. And by the way, a lot of it is necessary and needed disruption on the part of racial reckoning and women speaking out about wanting more equality. And then you have, you know, evangelicals like me, which probably admittedly is a very, very small minority, who maybe just identify with some of the theology and the beautiful picture of being born again and connecting with Jesus that way. But not, you know, not really sure where we fit. And then ex-evangelicals, but I don't know, what do you see happening with evangelical Christianity in the future? You know, mainline churches are growing, identification with evangelical is up, but it may be because Trump has just said, oh, he's for evangelicals, so that's what I am, you know, and I don't know, what's going on? Where do you see it going?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. And that is sort of one of the things that is preoccupying for me. I think a lot of these institutions, they're not going to, you know, crumble overnight. None of that. What I do think is always important to emphasize is that, like, yes, like evangelical stuff is trendy right now, like online, it's getting attention and it's drawing eyeballs and whatever, what have you. It is getting attention, but it's still super new. Like, in the grand scheme of history, this particular iteration of things is 5 years old. That's like nothing. And modern evangelical institutions can usually draw to, say, the late 19th century. And when you look at some of the stalwart institutions, from Moody Bible Institute, is like very, very important in the development of modern evangelicalism and creating multiple aspects of today's evangelical culture. Its sort of consumerist orientation, its role in sort of the corporate world.
Yeah,
Dwight, there's a lot of white evangelical.
Like, he was a businessman, right? So he could. There was a syncretism of capitalism and Christianity that kind of happened with.
Yeah, definitely. And there's a book that I'm reading right now called Guaranteed Pure, which is all about that story. And there's other books that entail it, like Evangelicals Incorporated is another book that looks at the development of an evangelical public and an evangelical market, particularly from the lens of the book market. But nonetheless, to your question, like a lot of these institutions, they're moneyed. They have political influence that's not going to evaporate, even as the sort of winds of change move along online. The Trump and McConnell stacked the judiciary. They made hay while the sun was shining through those 4 years. And like the sort of struggle, the culture wars and everything, they're still winning. Like, even though Biden won, like, Joe Manchin is being a stick in the mud and Kristen Sinema wants attention or whatever.
But she's so interesting, Blake. But, she like has pink hair and crazy glasses and she's bisexual.
She's also
like
a millionaire now.
Oh, is she supposed to like do law things too?
When you include all of those things, like, it's not exactly like everything's going to change overnight, even though we're all so oriented towards the present moment. And that's all sort of amplified by how we consume news and everything. I do think that these things do present a threat to those institutions. And it's not just evangelical, it's things like church too, decolonization movements, people of color contributing, speaking up, the Leave Loud campaign that The Witness did.
Jamar Tinsley, those.
Yeah. So like all of those things, I think we'll continue to see that. And I think we'll continue to sort of see people continuing to develop their own sort of idiosyncratic communities. And I'm not sure, like, Dave, like, I'm not sure what, you know, you said you're compelled by like the evangelical theology. I do think that might be a hard road. I don't know how, like, whether you're orienting towards like a Bevington quadrilateral sort of understanding of crucicentrism and conversionism and those four things, or if it's some other aspect of evangelical theology. It has become a much more social term or a political term. And that's always been the case. Evangelicalism defies easy definition.
True.
And we'll continue to see these things playing out. But I think for the next, if we're looking through like the next 5 years, I think we'll, one of the pandemic will end our sort of shift to more digital spaces. I think that's not going, that feature is not going away. A lot of these church, small churches, rural churches, whatever, like they had to learn how to become a digital space really fast. And I think that will be an interesting impact on spiritual development and really legitimize this idea of receiving spiritual formation, or developing community that exists primarily in a non-physical space.
Now, this show is not a debate show, if you want to hit Dave a little harder for still identifying as an evangelical, that's no, okay. I wrote a question for you of Dave is still an evangelical. Is that okay? and he thought that funny, but I'm serious because I have to do a show with this guy. He's my friend. Is it okay?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure you'd like, we haven't gotten into that, Dave, and like, as far as like why that particular identity or term still is evocative to you as one that you want to claim. And like, and I mean, if that, it, we haven't gotten into that, but I'm sure there are valid reasons. It's just, I guess I'm on the side of there's valid reasons to disassociate too. So like, sure. But I do know that there are people that are hesitant to use the term. And that's where, for me, where I like to get granular about how I understand the term is that it doesn't have to define all of you. Like white evangelicalism is something that has to have touch every part of your life. Or at least that's the way a lot of us experienced it. Mm-hmm. I think if other people can have other relationships to it, but that's sort of, I think maybe the majority experience. I'm open to talking about it, like, and hearing why you appreciate the term and what keeps you interested in it.
Yeah. And it's purely for theological reasons. And some of those reasons, the Bebbington quadrilateral, you know, there may be some nuances there, that I'd be different in, but, it's a complicated conversation because I think you are right. There is definitely a culture with it because we have a subculture. There's the book publishing industry that you mentioned. There's contemporary Christian music. There's that whole thing. And there's also the political arm, the religious right. And yeah, I actually had some questions for you that we didn't get to of like how, you know, politics is translated in evangelical churches, which I think is really interesting because I've had evangelical friends come to me and say, well, hey, I have been in a bunch of different evangelical churches and the pastor never talks about politics from the pulpit. But yet, as I mentioned before, there was a reason I was listening to Rush Limbaugh in high school. You know, right. Our pastor, back when I was converted at 14, I wasn't raised in a Christian home. I was converted to an evangelical church. And our pastor was a great man named Jack Rantz, and he really cared about people. He was, he was a compassionate, friendly, like he actually really liked people and liked doing a job. Yeah. He never mentioned politics from the pulpit, but at that church, it's the being a part of that culture and I guess cultural pressure. It's kind of like, well, Rush Limbaugh, these are our values. This is what you should believe in a political sense. And so there's a different kind of like pull and pressure toward that. So back to my story, if there's anything I'm deconstructing the political part and the cultural part for sure. But I mentioned in a previous episode, the idea of being born again, of having a connection with Jesus right now, spiritually, that impacts my life. I've always liked how that is emphasized within evangelicalism. And maybe people who have emphasized it have had different reasonings behind it. Maybe there's been different subtexts other than just a connection with the Jesus in scriptures. But that's the main reason why I still want to label myself, because that is still very critically meaningful to me. And it's not not the only way to know Jesus by any means. I'm not, you know, I mean, Catholics, Coptic Christians, Greek Orthodox, all beautiful aspects of their faith, all faced with problems as well. No church is perfect. I don't want to feel that as an excuse for horrible things that went on. I think we need to talk about the horrible things and repent and change what we can, radically get away from those things. I hope that answers your question. I mean, that's the critical
sense. Yeah, that's what appeals, and then that's what keeps you, because I mean, that is really what sort of drives my show, is like understanding how these things relate to someone's life, because ultimately it's something that you derive value from. Like, and so that is, we make all sorts of choices when we're using that, and whether it's something you derive like a particular type of identity from, or whether it's, like you said, theology, or and there's a lot there. So I'm
totally,
I'm, you know, I think I think that honestly, yes, people who use the term evangelical are snarky on Twitter or whatever, but that's because everybody's snarky on Twitter. And like,
oh, for sure.
You know, like, yeah. I'm happy to like, if Mike Cosper wanted to talk to me, he could talk to me. Like,
yeah, you instead, have him on the show.
You know, if he, you know,
he doesn't think Jesus is done with you.
maybe Jesus isn't done. I don't know. Maybe he is. Maybe he's fed up.
You were too busy talking. You couldn't hear the spirit telling you to shut the fuck
up. You gotta get it.
But anyways, I mean, no, the reason I mentioned Mike in that context is he's done Twitter threads talking about evangelicals vaguely, and then a whole bunch of them respond, and then it becomes a thing about like respectability politics and language used, and instead of, you know, talking about things. And there is something to be said about like people not being jerks to people they don't know online or aren't actually having a conversation with. But all that being said, I'm happy to talk to evangelicals. I just think that neither party needs to be deferential to the other, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that's from the evangelical or ex-evangelical or any other of the infinite other types of perspectives. Like, we can talk about our perspectives, and you know, to go back to Pedro, there might be some foregone conclusions there, but.
Yeah. There you go.
he was ahead of us all. He knew where it was all going.
Yeah, he did. Okay, sorry. One more. If we're gonna talk about Dave, I want to get your thoughts on the first episode of the Christianity Today Rise and Fall of Mars Hill podcast. Can I say famously ended with a Page of the Lion song? Slow and steady wins the race from Winners Never Quit.
I did see that in the show notes, and I was sort of shocked.
Yeah, I was shocked too. And then as I listened, and throughout the ending credits, the song kept playing, I realized that there was no way that they were going to let it play all the way to the end. And they literally played the entire song except for the final line. I won't have to lock my doors. I can trust my neighbors, confident that they deserve to be in heaven too.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like they let Dave slip really the knife in, but not editing. Twist it. Yeah. And I'd love to know Dave's thought on that. Cause like here that I'm like, they took the teeth out. They took out the whole part of the song that turned the mirror back on the listener and could have started the whole podcast out with like, there is deep rot and problems within evangelical culture. And
yeah. Yeah. I mean,
just that one line taking it out. But like, no, nope.
That's another Pedro story is what I had this really shitty summer job 1 year where my friend and I would clean vacant storage units. Yeah. That's all we would do. We were maintenance for a storage unit chain in the area. And yeah, that's what we did. So we would just listen to a lot of music on one of our iPods or whatever. And because I think by that time iPods are out. And Winners Never Quit, the last song on that album, like literally we were in this climate controlled, all white, sterile, semi-sterile type place. And that song comes on and I just like sat down and just like couldn't move for like 5 minutes because it just like had the ability to just sort of freeze you. And I still remember that. I can, that's a physical memory.
It's amazing. It's amazing what music does for us.
Yeah.
I'm so glad that we've had Dave to help us out through these times.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, Blake, yeah, it was a real pleasure to meet you. I honestly like I know you're like a very nice guy, very polite, but I felt like nervous, like overwhelmed and you know, part of that like is continuing to have these conversations good for my mental health sort of feelings. Yeah. But I've really wanted to have your voice be part of our show and have our listeners hear about what you have to say, as I feel far more strongly identifying with ex-evangelicals. I want to have more of those voices be part of the conversations that we have here. And I couldn't think of a better person to have one with than you. So,
yeah. Yeah. Thank you, Zach and Dave, for having me on your show. And I hope that as you sort of explore, you know, what that sort of term means for however long it's meaningful to you, like, I hope that you find the sort of stuff that you need. Wherever it comes from. So, and wherever it leads, I hope it leads you to a place that's healthy.
Thanks. You too. So,
yeah.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. This was a fun conversation. We touched on a lot of stuff.
So, wide ranging as usual.
Yes.
Yeah. Dave's going to be busy editing.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Veterans of Culture Wars. Please make sure where you get your podcast to subscribe to our podcast. And if you could, rate and leave us a review as that helps others find our show. Our great thanks to Blake Chastain, the host of the Ex-Evangelical Podcast, for joining us on this episode. You can follow him at BR Chastain on Twitter. You can also follow at Ex-Evangelical Pod and find his shows and links to everything that he's doing there. You can follow us on Twitter at VCW Pod. Zach is at Muzach, M-U-Z-A-C-H. I am at Dave J. Lester. You can check out some of Zach's art and music at muzach.bandcamp.com. Zach has dug out some apocalyptic songs that he did that you can listen to for free on his site. You can also order his Christmas album on vinyl ahead of the holiday here and enjoy that really, really great record. You can visit my website, www.dangeroushope.wordpress.com, if you want to read some of my musings and writings about Christ, film, sermons, all that kind of stuff. Music and logo for the show done by Zach. We'll see you next time.